For nearly 90 years, the world has been chasing Amelia Earhart. Searchers have crossed oceans. Researchers have spent lifetimes buried in archives. Expeditions have scanned the seafloor. Investigators have followed leads from Howland Island to Nikumaroro, from Saipan to Buka, from Washington, D.C. to Tokyo. And yet, despite all of that effort, despite the documents, the witness statements, the photographs, the theories, and the classified files, one simple question still remains unanswered. What happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan? It's a mystery that has inspired some of the most rigorous investigations imaginable, but it's also inspired something else. Questions that exist far beyond aviation, far beyond history. Questions about memory, consciousness, and whether the boundaries of human experience are far wider than we realize. Tonight's guest has spent much of his career exploring exactly those frontiers. He's an award-winning filmmaker, author, and researcher whose work has taken him deep into subjects that, depending on your beliefs, you'll find fascinating or impossible. Near-death experiences, past life memories, hypnosis, consciousness. The possibility that awareness itself survives physical death. For decades, he's interviewed hundreds of people who claim to remember things that they shouldn't know. People who describe experiences that challenge conventional explanations. Stories that exist somewhere between testimony, mystery, and the unknown. And unlike many who enter these conversations, he doesn't simply ask people what happened. He asks what can be learned from it. What can be tested, what patterns emerge, and whether there might be something hiding beneath the surface that we've all overlooked. Which brings us to Amelia Earhart, because over the years, tonight's guest has found himself pulled toward a mystery that many of us in this audience know all too well. Not through crash reports or navigation charts, not through military records, but through a series of experiences and interviews that led him to ask a question most Earhart researchers would never consider. What if there are avenues of investigation that we've dismissed before ever even examining them? It's a question that makes many people uncomfortable, and that's okay. The Amelia Earhart case has always lived at the crossroads of evidence and belief. We've explored eyewitnesses, we've explored rumors, we've explored memories recorded decades after the fact. We've examined claims that challenge conventional wisdom, and we've also challenged those claims when the evidence has failed to support them. That's what this show has always been about. Following the evidence wherever it leads. Asking difficult questions, and being willing to look. Being equally willing to walk away when the answers don't hold up. This doesn't happen all too often for this show. In fact, tonight's conversation ventures into territory that we've never explored on Chasing Earhart. That alone is pretty remarkable, all things considered. We're going to talk about consciousness. We're going to talk about memory. And we're going to talk about the possibility that some mysteries may not fit neatly inside the boxes that we've built for them. Because whether you agree with his conclusions or not, his journey into the Earhart mystery represents something that has always fascinated me. The willingness to ask a different kind of question. To approach an old mystery from an entirely different angle. And sometimes, that's where the most interesting conversations begin. So, wherever you're listening from tonight, get ready. Keep an open mind. Stay curious. And as always, listen and decide for yourself. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From Chicago, Illinois, by way of the flip side, this is Rich Martini. Mr. Richard Martini, I feel like I've slipped into the multiverse, but welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'm a fan of your work because I had a chance the other day to look through all the people that you've interviewed. And
yeah.
You know, not that I'm the last of the bunch, but I must say you pretty much interviewed everybody that I've ever run across.
Yeah. And,
you know, just to qualify why I'm on your show, it was about 1988
right.
when My old girlfriend wrote me a letter and said, "Hey, why don't you make a movie about Amelia Earhart? I just finished my movie Limit Up about the world's first soybean trader who was a woman." And I thought, "Yeah, that's funny. We didn't have the internet back then, but I did look up to find out that Valerie Burton Elliott did a TV movie, but other than that,
that's
there was
right.
the RKO picture version, which oddly enough comes back into my life later on. But ultimately, the question was answered by me saying to her, well, why don't we do that together? So she flew out to LA, and the two of us, over a weekend, wrote a screenplay. I ended up showing it to my agent, who then took it to Diane Keaton.
Yeah.
And on Monday, I was told, we're doing it. We're making it with Ted Turner.
That's fast.
And I haven't even checked the typos. But you know, they didn't really mean that, because Diane took my script into Ted Turner and they set up her movie. And then I got a call from my agent saying, oh, they've hired an Emmy Award winning writer who's a woman who's not you.
Yeah.
And so I'll tell you, at the time I thought, well, that's kind of rude. I don't think you're allowed to do that. And it turned out weren't, and they had to pay me something, whatever.
Yeah.
And I ran into Diane some years later and I said, why'd you do that? I mean, you didn't know me.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is, if I had worked on that movie back in whenever it was, we wouldn't be here talking. I would have been done. But instead, I said to her at the time when she said, well, I don't really know you. I said, well, I guess now I have to do my own version. Here we are.
And here we are.
I've written screenplays. And way back in the 90s, I took a deep dive into the stories about her.
Well, just to give you my side of things, I whine about this a lot, and I'm sure the audience is quite tired of hearing it. But when I started this thing back in 2014-ish, I made up a list. And I remember asking myself at the time, who do I need in order to tell this story? Who is essential? And you were on that list. And I have to tell you, in my mind, you know, there's really no way we can discuss Japanese capture without you, because you were the catalyst, really, to getting the United States military on record about what they saw, what they experienced. And without that, I don't believe the theory packs enough of a punch. So, you know, I've been waiting for this night for a very long time. The book was She Was Never Lost, The Amelia Earhart Saga. I will have it linked in the show's notes for tonight. Here's what I want to do. I want to do this right, and I want to try and stay on a path that tells a narrative, because when Amelia and Fred hit Japanese custody, it gets wild really fast. So let me just ask you this to start, clean and simple. Where do you believe Amelia Earhart actually died?
So I just want to clarify two things. One is, when we were, you know, just meeting for the first time here on the show, I was asking you your background, like, why do you want to tell her story? So the answer came, do we want to find out where she is or who she is?
Right.
I was pointing out that you're chasing Amelia. You're not only chasing where she is, which is what everybody seems to want to know, but I think what Amelia is interested in is who she was.
Yeah.
Which is a story that's never been told. And I've read every single one that's out there. Let's put it that way. Of course, I was hired by Fox to do the history on the Amelia movie.
Right.
Hillary Swank. And I listed as the digital media curator. I had over 3,000 or 4,000 JPGs of her. I had 30 hours of footage. I'd gathered everything because of my research. And ultimately, Philip Noyce had come to me and said that he was going to direct that film. And so he, my good friend, and he said, I want to buy all your research.
Right.
Or I want you to give it to me. And I said, you can lease it. And what I did was I built a website so that they could access everything I had. So if Hilary Swank was going to do a scene where she said something, I had the footage linked on your cell phone that you could see the day, what she was wearing, what she did that day. And then I had all the text from all the books. So I got a chance. Somebody paid me enough money to get all the obscure text that you can find. Any one of those books allowed me sort of a background. And then after the film, I went off to work on Salt with Noyce.
Yeah.
And the movie came out, and we know, you know, very, very few people saw it, and they had sort of changed the storyline. There had been a storyline with her being in secret romance with Gore Vidal's father.
Yeah.
And that didn't pan out, so they took that out of the script. I introduced them to Elgin Long, who was a researcher, and they hired him, and he used some of his book. It's interesting. So So your question is, where do I think she is buried, or whether
where do you think she died? Yeah, there's correct. A big difference there. Yeah,
no, I understand. And so I've always been of this mind, which is, what does the data say? What does the footage say? I'm filming people recounting things. I've been to Saipan. You've had so many amazing people on your show. I know I've talked to Les Kinney. I worked with Les.
Yes.
Mike Harris and I went to Saipan together. He was one of
Yes, Les, he speaks very highly of you. Yeah.
Well, he's a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
He's the best ukulele player I've ever met.
But
Les Kinney has been there 20 times. When Mike and I went there with an open mind. You know, this is, I'd read Fred Gerner's book, and I knew that over 200 people seen her on Saipan.
Right.
And those people, I've read their testimony. And then while we were there, the first people we interviewed, they were like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. No, I don't think Amelia Earhart was here. But I learned quickly that Saipanese will not say something they didn't see.
Right.
But if you ask them, what was your experience during World War II? They'll start telling you, well, we were friendly with the Japanese. They were been our country from 1914 on, and we all had relationships and friendships and businesses together. But then in 1939, when the troops came from Manchuria, everything changed. The soldiers were rude and cruel and executed people who didn't bow low enough. And it changed. And they kicked all the Saipanese out of their homes, put them up in the hills. They lived in caves. And I interviewed a number of these people. And then I would say, now, did you ever hear any of your relatives talk about an American flyer? And then at that point, they would tell the same story. So this is consistent reports. I had 15 new eyewitnesses, including two gentlemen in their 80s who came to us and said, and they didn't know that each one had seen the same thing at the same day. In May of 1944, somewhere in spring, they saw Amelia on the back of a truck with two other American pilots, two other American soldiers.
Right.
And at the time, I thought, are they talking about Fred? You know, maybe there's some. But no, they were talking about these two other guys. And how I found out from Les Kinney that they were two pilots who had been shot down who were surveying Saipan. And their names are a matter of public record. I mentioned them in the book. And they actually were executed. One was shot and the other one was beheaded. And they actually had an inquest after the war to find out, had their bodies been tortured? A Geneva Convention inquest, this according to Les Kinney. And they had not. So the people who had executed them were exonerated, as if that was okay.
Right.
But I know it sounds weird, but at the same time, these gentlemen saw Amelia on a truck in the spring of 1944. They didn't know each other. They both said the same story. The truck had driven around the road that's on Saipan, and they saw her on the back of that truck. Now, that corroborated tons of other stories, which is people who said they saw her there, they saw her incarcerated, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'd heard that Fred had died early on. Mm-hmm. I'd heard varying accounts, but mostly the consistent report was that Fred had died for being a spy. Mm-hmm. Either he had confessed to being a spy, or he said he was a spy so that it would put the light off of her. I don't know. He was beheaded. And when people hear that, they think of that as a horrible way to go. But in the code of the Japanese soldier, that was the honorable way to go, because your spirit went straight to the heaven, supposedly, whereas a gunshot would be something less than honorable. But he was cremated. And I've been to the Saipan prison, and most people don't realize there's about 20 yards beyond the prison, there's a crematorium that's there for the Buddhist cemetery. And that's where I'm told his body was cremated and he became ash. Now, you've heard the story about where the two GIs, Hansen and Burke, claimed that they had dug her up.
Yes.
I read that story and I thought that was pretty uncanny. But then I found an article in UPI, the Chicago Tribune, January 1977, where these guys were interviewed in Chicago, and off camera, once the interview was done, they both said, you know, what's weird about the story is when we dug up her body, we only found a partial rib cage and an arm and a canister of ashes. Most people go, well, what happened to the arm? Where did the arm go? Who did they deliver to the arm? Where did that? Okay, that's a valid question. My question is, where'd the rest of her go? Les Kinney, I'll tell you, I'm sure he told you, he's been to the cemetery where they said that she is buried, but she's not there now.
Right.
So she's been moved. Okay, we know that, let's say. And I had heard on Saipan two different people who reported during the war, they heard that American pilot had been beheaded.
Right.
And the other story was that an American pilot had been shot. As it turns out, those are the two guys in the back of the truck.
Oh,
one
man.
Beheaded and the other was shot.
Yeah.
So the question became, how did she die? And right. The answer, which, as you know, in the book, comes out of quite a long journey of mediums coming to me personally, not me seeking them out, them coming to me and saying, somebody wants to talk to you from the other side. And eventually I'm asking the question to whoever this is that seems like, is it Amelia? And she says, I died of dysentery. Now, there are reports, and that's in the historical record of people who were there. They said that she died of dysentery, but
that's right.
I'm pretty sure right away, that's the way, I think Les Kinney feels that that's what happened. It was right away she died of dysentery.
Yeah.
But all I can say is nobody talked about burying her, and nobody talked about what happened, and nobody talked about, the rest of her body.
Right.
That was my focus. Where's the rest of her body, and where's the plane?
Right. Well, what do you think of Mike Harris's claim of them digging and finding the rag that she supposedly had over her eyes?
Well, and Mike's a good friend. And Mike is accurate about that story in that he filmed a guy telling that story.
Right.
So it's like telling the story of her being shot. There was an old woman that he interviewed who said she saw her, Amelia, back in the 1980s, that she saw Amelia taken out of a sidecar by a Jeep, asked to kneel, and shot, okay?
Right, right.
So, but I went to where that incident occurred. I was on Saipan, and we drove to the actual spot where the breadfruit tree, where they ended up digging up the rag.
Okay? Yeah, digging up the rag,
And then we went to the spot where she would have had to have seen it, because the road is 150 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is, one of those two airmen was shot and one was beheaded. She saw the guy shot.
Mm-hmm.
She just didn't know that it wasn't Amelia. You see, her viewpoint couldn't have identified whether it was a male or female.
I gotcha.
And so finding that rag, that guy did find a rag when he dug up the thing, but it wasn't her blindfold. She didn't have a blindfold, according to everybody that I've spoken to. So going there to Saipan, and I want to point this out, because this is kind of one of those things that I've been up against, and the reason I've always been reluctant to have these kinds of conversations.
Uh-huh.
While I was on Saipan, the Marianas Variety, which is the newspaper of record, printed an article planted by somebody who's been on your show that said, these people that come here and they interview people on the islands, they're projecting what they want to hear in the answers of the person they're interviewing, as if I don't know how to interview somebody.
Right.
And I've been working in the film business for 40 years, and the idea that I wouldn't know the protocol behind asking people questions. And again, it's footage. And if
you
look at the footage and if you look at the transcript, and by the way, I did put out a documentary back in 2008, because at the time it was like I wasn't ready to write a book.
Right.
So I just put out as much information I had. Here's what I think is most interesting to your audience and to you.
Yeah.
Which goes to the, I know we were going to talk about Julius Neighbors, Erskine Julius Neighbors, E.J. Neighbors.
Yeah.
And I just want to get to, how did I get to this U.S. Marine? And it was, I read Tom Devine's book with Mike Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Devine's book, was claimed that he had seen her plane on Saipan, and he claimed to have seen it destroyed on Saipan.
Right.
And so I called him up, and I had, like I say, I've been doing research at this point for quite some time. I called him up and I said, what's your story? And he said, why don't you come by and I'll tell you. So he was very ill at the time. He was literally in his deathbed.
Yeah.
And I filmed this interview with him. Mike was a real adamant guy. He had a point of view of what happened. I don't know if you remember that story. He went with Fred Gerner back to Saipan, and he said, this is the cemetery where an islander told me she was buried. And Fred Gerner was like, no, I think it's this other cemetery. And that's where they went to dig. And so Tom Devine, middle of the night, gets out with a spoon and goes to the cemetery and digs where he's and he finds a bone. Oh. And he brings that bone home. So while I'm interviewing him, he's like to his wife, you know, bring the bone down. So he brings down this bone out in a bag, you know.
Oh, man.
So, by the way, Tom passes away. His wife sends me the bone.
Yeah.
So you think, well, what is that? So where do I go? Film guy that I am, I go to see the famous forensic pathologist, Michael Bodden.
Mm-hmm.
He happens to be giving a lecture in Miami. And I don't tell him why I want to ask this question. I apologize profusely for going up at the end of his talk. And I hand him this bone. And I said, can you tell me what this is? And he said, it's a cow bone.
I
just want to say, Tom was a guy who believed something and carried it. He had a real paranoid thing, like the government wants to kill me. And I was thinking, dude, how hard can that be? You're literally on your deathbed. Not to tease him about that, but still, Tom Devine leads me to E.J. Neighbors, because in his book, this Erskine Neighbors, Julius Neighbors, we went by, he wrote a letter that said, you know, I also saw the plane and destroyed.
Okay. Right.
So I called him up. I looked him up. I found his number. He lived in a town in Mississippi. I'm just going to recount it as it happened. I called him on the phone and I said, now listen, I saw that you were in Tom Devine. What do you remember?
Yeah.
He said, Richard, I remember it as if it was yesterday. It's as clear as a bell. I said, hold that thought. I'll be on a plane tomorrow. I'll be in your backyard the next day.
Yeah.
As somebody with that kind of recall, I'm interested.
Yeah. I hear you.
I went down there in Baldwin, Mississippi, and his wife made me some mud pie. That very nice couple. And then I sat in his backyard and I turned my camera on and I got a full body chill because as he started to speak, I realized I was recording something no one had ever heard before. Because Erskine Neighbors, Julius Neighbors, was the wire operator in the tent of Lieutenant Colonel Clarence Wallace, highly decorated Marine whose uniform hangs in Quantico. And he now starts to tell me how June 19th, 1944, over the wire, he said, came this message from SYNCPAC, Pacific Command Headquarters. We have found Amelia Earhart's airplane at Aslito Airfield. And so Wallace turned to him and said, get your gear. You're going to go down there and guard that plane. So he takes Neighbors. They get in the Jeep. They go to the plane. It's in a hangar. This is what he tells me. It's in a hangar. By the time I got there, he said, the doors were down. Everything was locked.
Right.
But he had to guard the plane from anybody going in to see it. And people came by, including Tom Devine, who overheard a conversation.
Yeah.
They called it somebody with Navy brass looking people, went up and said, we understand Amelia Earhart's airplane's in there. We want to see it. And Neighbors said, orders is orders. You can't get in there to see it. And he said he took out a sidearm. He was going to protect, you know, his orders.
Yeah.
Tom witnessed that. So that weird conversation, I'm interviewing two different people who witnessed the same conversation at the same time. And now I meet Doug Bryce. Doug Bryce is a veteran who was serving on Saipan and Mount Tapachow. And this poor guy, you know, he told people this story and they all mocked him about it. But he heard while he was up there on Mount Tapachow working on top radio towers, they said, you know, we found Earhart's plane down on the strip. He was like, what? So they got on a Jeep, he and a friend of his, and they drove down and they parked the Jeep within 30 feet of the plane. And it's the same hangar that Neighbors had described to me, the same visual.
Yeah.
But they could see the plane. And as Doug said to me, it's the most famous plane in the world. She'd only been missing 7 years. It's not like we didn't know what it was. And they were guarding it.
Yeah.
So here's where it gets kind of unusually... Well, in my world, not so much. After I finish the book, after I put the book out, I get one of those YouTube links. You know, the algorithm sends me something, thinks I'd be interested in.
Yeah.
The liberation of Aslito Airfield by U.S. Marines on June 18th, 1944.
Oh,
that's the day before neighbors said that he decoded that message. So now I'm looking at this footage, which I had seen many times before, but someone had cleaned it up. So it's beautiful. 16 millimeter, right. Pure, and you could see there. So they're driving around the field, and they go by. There's two hangars that are still in existence. One is filled with war material.
Right.
But the other hangar has three airplanes inside it. Again, this is the day before they announced finding it. There's only two hangars. All the rest are destroyed. There's planes outside, but there's three inside. Now, remember, neighbors told me the plane was inside a hangar. So now you have to think, if a Marine finds something, let's say, important, he's not going to get up and move it. They're not going to move it from wherever they find it. They're going to wait for orders. So the cameraman puts the camera inside that hangar, and he pans from left to right. And you can see clearly two single-engine planes uncovered, just the engine. But the rest of it is covered under a tarp. And then in the corner is a plane parked sideways because it didn't fit in the same way.
Right.
And it occurred to me, because the Electra had a wider wingspan, they had parked it sideways so they could close the doors, but it was still covered.
Yeah.
And in that moment, it occurred to me, that's the only hangar. That's the only. So I went and I got some footage. I tried to match it. I tried to see if I could superimpose one on the other. All I can say is, you know, I'm sure someone will argue, no, they don't fit, blah, blah, blah. But logic tells you there's only one hangar with planes in it. And that next day, neighbors goes down there, guards that plane. Now, why is neighbors so interesting? Because other things that he corroborates, which is he decodes a message that says they're going to fly Amelia Earhart's airplane 2 weeks later.
Right, right. Yes.
Something Tom Devine reports.
Right.
Neighbors didn't go down and watch it, but he, reported. He decoded that. And Devine got a bunch of GIs who said they saw it. But then he said 2 to 3 weeks after that, he decoded the message that said, we're going to destroy Amelia Earhart's airplane at such and such time on the airplane.
Yeah.
And so, but this one, neighbors thinks, I want to see that. So he and a fellow guy from St. Paul, he said, fellow Marine, they get in the Jeep and they go down there, but they hide because they don't think they're supposed to be there. And they go up behind the bunker, which is where Mike Harris and I were there, actually. It's weird. I was talking to Mike about this with Mike the other day. We were right where they were standing behind some bushes and trees.
Yeah.
It's a huge bunker. Anyway, and what neighbors describes is exactly what Tom Devine describes. They covered it with fuel. They had a P-38, which sounded crazy to me, but they had a P-38 shoot up the plane. Now, why they did it that way, I don't know. But two guys corroborate the same story. So the plane is destroyed. Then I talked to some guys, friends of mine in the CIA, and I was like, what do you do with planes that you're trying to get rid of? And somebody who had been in the, you know, Contra thing, he said, you know, we followed the Army manual, which was you dug a pit and you pushed all the planes off the runway and into the pit and you covered it. Now, I've been to that pit, which is in Naftan Point, down at the old airport. Mike and I talked to people who said over the years, you know, this is where all the planes were shoved because they moved the airfield from Oslito to Tinian because they built a whole new airfield. And that's, of course, where Fat Man and Little Boy were delivered. Oh, and the other thing about neighbors that makes him so interesting is he told me in the interview that he decoded the message that the USS Indianapolis had been sunk by a Japanese sub. Now, we all know historically those guys were not rescued.
That's true.
So he knew the day that it had been sunk, but no one went to and the reason they didn't rescue them is the same reason people don't know this story, because it would have shown the Japanese that they had broken their codes.
Mm-hmm.
They had broken their codes in the late 30s. That's a matter of record.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the Enigma machine. There's the apocryphal story. Apparently, it's not true, but people would say, like, Churchill would not be able to save friends of his, you know, because they knew what the German code was. So that's why the book's called She Was Never Lost.
Huh.
Knew where she was. The U.S. knew where she was, but couldn't reveal it because it would show they had broken their codes. And the Japanese knew where she was.
Right.
And so where did she die? Beyond any shadow of doubt from me, I know where she died.
Right.
And I know where she's buried because I've taken the time to ask her directly, which relates to our first question, which is, what did she want me to tell? And I've asked her, and you know, we can go into that in a bit.
Yeah.
The answer is always, it's stop looking for me. I'm fine. I'm back home. I'm on the other side.
Yeah.
Where my bones are isn't important. She says it. And I think, well, no, it's kind of important. But no, who am I to argue?
In the grand scheme of things, yeah.
But she wants people to know her life. And so that allowed me to dig deeply into her poetry, which is at Purdue University. And George Putnam had two things. George Putnam had delivered her poetry, but he had cut out paragraphs.
Right.
And so when you find the original poetry and compare what he cut out, it's all the stuff she was talking about her girlfriend. That part he eliminated from the poetry. So when you look at that, you see, oh my gosh, these are poems about love between two women. But he edited that part out. And the second thing was, when I was interviewing Elgin Long, I remember well, in my coffee shop here in Santa Monica, I said, so did you ever talk to anybody associated with Amelia? He said, yeah, I interviewed Dorothy Putnam, which was George Putnam's wife.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, so tell me, what did she say? He said, you know, she said something funny. She said that she walked in on George and Amelia and another woman in bed together.
Mm.
And I said, well, why didn't you report that? Why didn't you put that in your book? He said, I thought she made it up. I said, why would she make that up? He said, oh, jealous wife. You know, she was trying to denigrate. Wait a second. If you know her story, George and her got divorced on Saturday, and she was married again by the following Saturday to her boyfriend from South America. So they had an open marriage. But, you know, she was the crayon heiress.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, so that set me back, which because, of course, I was like, well, who's the third woman? Who is that? Was that somebody for George, or was that somebody for Amelia? That sort of stayed with me. So I don't know if you want to drift into this other area of mediums reaching out to me.
People want to know about the whole spy thing. So let me just ask you this bluntly.
Yeah.
Do you believe that Amelia knowingly would have participated in a spy mission, or is it possible that maybe this could have been pulled off while keeping her on sort of like a need to know basis? How much would she have been involved? And would it have required her to be that involved if there was indeed a spy mission of some kind going on?
So my answer is a little complicated, but I think we need to think of the era. We got to roll back our time machine. Now, you remember, Amelia is a person who created the Equal Rights Amendment. And the reason she did that is because women were not treated equally. As she said, a pilot is a pilot. There's no gender associated. So when she flew her flights, she was not treated the way male pilots were treated. Let's just put it that way, frankly.
Right.
There was some discussion about why her plane fell apart on the crossing that she did, you know, when she wasn't in the back of the plane, she was flying the plane, and it fell apart while she was flying it. The engine caught on fire and all these other, and she said it's because the mechanics had not prepared it for long distance. They prepared it for short distance, but within that comment, which is, by the way, in the book, The Last Flight.
Right.
Where she talks about, you know, her problems with mechanics. I can only say they treated her differently than they did other explorers. And now the guy who, I think his name was Haley, the U.S. Navy conduit who was in charge of helping her and helping George with the plane. At some point, Amelia writes a letter, Pam, at her public record, where she starts talking about the mission, about the not the mission, but about the journey, right? The flight that they're going to take. And she's asking questions about, like, how are we going to do this? And how am I going to refuel? And how are these? The response that Haley, I can't think of that as his name. I could have it wrong. But the response that the Navy Department have is, I think, along the lines of, why is she asking us questions? She's not in charge of any aspect of this. We're in charge of the aspect of it. So if you look at just the facts and the mistakes. So Harry Manning was her navigator.
Right.
That was on the plane, and he was very good. He was very famous for that. And for whatever reason, when the plane ground looped in Hawaii, he split. He said, "I'm not doing this. I quit." Right.
Yeah.
And so why did he quit? But here's what Elgin Long told me, was that he was the one who set up all the navigation conversation. So all of the supposed communication between her and the Itasca was supposed to be in Morse code, because that's the language of Harry Manning. But if you look at the book Last Flight, she's talking to two Thai pilots when she's flying around the world. And she says in that paragraph, "You know, Fred and I never learned Morse code."
Yeah. And we wouldn't be having this conversation right now if that was the case.
So if you think about that for half a second, you think, so the task is only talking to her in Morse code. They did ask her to send the letter A, which she did. So she responded. But, you know, how many people don't know the letter A?
Right.
Do you know the letter A in Morse code?
No, I don't actually. No. So there you go.
I just throw that out there as a joke.
Yeah.
But in those days, people knew it anyway. So she answers. Yeah. But from that point forward, she just uses voice.
Yeah.
And they respond in Morse code. So it was like, that's a huge error. Now, the other anomaly, and this is the part where this is theoretical on my part, and all I can say is, I've asked Amelia on the flip side, am I right about this theory? And I get the answer, yes. And of course, you have to go, well, that's what you wanted to hear. But I noticed that when she was doing a test flight with the Electra and Paul Mantz, you know, the famous pilot, a good pal, they were flying around the Pacific, and they were supposed to fly back to Burbank.
Right.
Paul Mantz somewhere said, "You know where you are?" And she's like, "Yeah, I'm right above Burbank." And he was like, "No, you're right above Fresno." So she was 250 miles off, northwest of where she thought she was. Why is that? I don't know. I've never flown an Electra. Can you lean a little bit? I don't know. But in terms of her flight into Dakar.
Bangladesh,
East Pakistan as it was, or maybe it was even before it was East, but in her flight into that, she was 200 miles northwest.
Yeah.
And she said to Fred, where are we? And he was like, "You're 200 miles off." And she was mad at him. And now that's in the book, Last Flight. She was mad at him. Like, how could you do that? How could you be so far off? She blamed him for it, right?
Yeah.
So she had a tendency to be 200. So, all right, now when you just look at the data, she's supposed to be above Howland. She's saying, "We're right above you, but we don't see you." There was a cloud cover.
Right.
But then the plan, and according to quite a few people who've done the research, the plan B was that she would take a left and go to the Gilberts. That was the safety, the backup place where she would land, the nearest place. The Nicomororo scenario.
Right.
Right? That's what she was supposed to do.
Right.
But she was 250 miles northwest of where she thought she was. And what's that? The Marshalls. So now you just have to go, well, wait a second. Does anybody see her come down? Yes. Dick Spink, you've had him on your show. He's interviewed the children of fishermen who were there fishing in the same spot that they go. And this idea that it's a deserted island is such a misnomer. You know, only white people, Caucasians, would think islands are deserted. Natives go there all the time.
Yeah.
They get copa. They fish. They use them. They use the island.
Right.
Why wouldn't? And so these fishermen are fishing, and they, you know, report seeing this silver plane come out of the sky and land on the coral reef. And so, you know the story with Dick Spink. I went up and I met Dick Spink, and he showed me the pieces that he had brought back from Milia Toll. And I was there with his buddy Jim Hayton, who was a NTSB investigator.
Who will be on the show very soon.
Congress. Oh, he's fantastic. I'm curious what he thinks about all this. I'm going to tell you something about Jim. I'm going to tell you a good question for Jim in a second. Okay. So Jim shows me, because he owns an Electra brake assembly system. Now think how weird that is. He just happens to own the 1937.
What are the odds? Yeah.
And he shows me where the dust cover that Dick Spink brought, how it fits. And then, of course, doing my internet skills, I find the manual from 1937, and there's the dust shield. And he's showing me exactly how it fits on the plane. And on camera, I recorded him saying it. I know Dick has had it in his work. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, my expertise tells me this piece could only have come from her plane, her Electra. And then you have the books by people who interviewed the Islanders on Miliatol, the Queen of Mili, who said that they saw her plane come down. And in one of the books, they saw her bury a metal case. Whether that's true or not, we don't know, but that's right. What they said. And now, your question was she a spy? I interviewed the son of the mechanic, former Lockheed employee, who installed two Fairchild aerial reconnaissance cameras on her plane. The son told me that his father, who went on to become a California Highway Patrolman, who had passed away, and I had read about that in Randall Brink's book.
But oh, yeah.
I checked this guy down, and I was like, is this accurate? And then the son is saying, you know, my father said this, and he had seen it in, according to the father, he had seen it in microfiche. So now the question is, what happened to those two Fairchild cameras? Let's say,
right.
Or one,
right.
Or even right. One.
Or even now, one.
When she leaves Ley, it's late at night. She can't fly there. She had, because a storm is coming up, she has to leave early.
Mm-hmm.
And so she leaves at night. So you couldn't have filmed anything anyway. Those cameras only work during the day. The question is, was she aware? Well, she's quoted as saying, imagine me being a spy. That's overheard.
Yeah. Right.
So she's aware that they're asking her, as men do, we're going to fix your plane. But, you know, in return for fixing your plane, you're going to do this little favor for me. But she gets to New Guinea and goes, you know what? With your favor, I don't have time. I can't be bothered. And she flies there. Now, there's another little detail. I interviewed Rick Spooner, who is a U.S. Marine, well-decorated guy. While he was stationed on Saipan, he said they found a photo album in a Japanese commander's office. And what he said about the photo album was, he didn't see it personally, but he heard from everybody else. They were pictures of Amelia in different airports and not Japanese people.
Right.
Okay. So now think about that for a minute. How would a Japanese soldier get a photo album of photographs of Amelia in the middle of the war on Saipan? And here's the answer. If you look at the photographs from Purdue, the last trip that she took, because all of that photo work went over in New Guinea, were given over, and that became part of the book. There are photographs of her with a small Leica where she's taking pictures in her own camera.
Yeah.
That footage has never been seen. Anyway, and ultimately, it's funny, I keep dropping these little things, and then I'm like, oh, what did I just say? I was going to go back to something. I did want to say that, you know, that footage that I found of her plane, or a plane covered over inside that hangar, to me,
right,
is evidence that they found, because it's June 19th, 1944, or it's June 18th when they took the footage.
Right.
And then June 19th, neighbors reports that they found the plane at Oslo, and other people corroborate his story.
Right.
And so if they find the plane on Oslo airfield and you want to argue, like, how did it get there? Well, you know, did she? Well, no. She landed it on Mili Atoll. It was picked up by a barge. Here's another weird thing. Doug Bryce, I mentioned him. He's the guy who drove in a Jeep to see the plane. When he comes back from World War II, they're having a family picnic in Colorado, where he's from. And they're going around, and they're saying, what happened to you during the war? Where was your story? And he starts talking to his brother, Andrew. Andrew tells the story. He's like, well, I was a stevedore on Majuro. You know, I was offloading Navy equipment.
Right.
Not something he wanted to do, didn't like doing it. But he was talking to a stevedore there, somebody who was a local.
Right.
And so he starts talking about this area. And he says to the guy, you ever hear about Amelia Earhart? You know, her plane went down somewhere in the Pacific. Do you ever hear that? And the guy says, yeah, I transported it off Mili Atoll. He says he put it aboard a jet. He was a stevedore. So he put it aboard a barge. He said they covered it. And they took it to this ship, this Japanese ship in Majuro. And now, of course, now we have eyewitnesses. Mike Harris interviewed the doctor who went aboard that Japanese ship and treated Amelia's wounds. And I interviewed the business partner of Billiman Ameron. And this guy was like, I was his business. He's from Boston. He was like, I was a construction engineer and contractor, and I was his business partner for 30 years. And if he was the most honest guy I've ever met. If he said he worked on Amelia, he did. And Mike had footage of this guy telling the story of treating Fred was more wounded than Amelia. And then I, you know, on Saipan, I have the son of a nurse who treated her in the hospital. Oh, and here's something really mind bending. Chris, I'm on a plane from LA to Chicago. I'm flying home on United. I start talking to this older gentleman next to me, and he's kind of yakking away, and I'm looking out the window, you know, kind of thinking this is going to be a long ride. And then he pops in there, you know, I was wounded on Saipan. I turn to him. I go, well, let me ask you, did you ever hear anything about Amelia Earhart? He lights up. He said, you know,
God, what are the odds?
Well, in my world.
Probably well, pretty good in your world, yeah.
He says, you know, it's funny you're asking me that. Everybody in the hospital was talking about how they found her plane down on Aslito Airfield.
Right, right. Yeah, it's there's definitely not any shortage of people that are filling in the gaps and saying that that's what happened, for sure.
And then when you think, like, how could it be? I mean, I didn't seek this guy out. I wasn't looking for him. He just randomly, you know, showed up. When Mike Harris and I went to Saipan, and you can find this Earhart on Saipan.com. I put all the footage from what we did. And there's a talk that we gave. It's probably too long. I probably talk too much. But we interviewed all these people on Saipan, and many of them had never spoken before, where, you know, they talked about how there was a guy that had worked at the airfield and had come over to their house and had said, you know, I saw Amelia Earhart's airplane in the airfield. You know, we worked on the hangar.
Yeah.
And other people who saw her incarcerated there. And so now it does get to the point, which is, why tell this story? Why hasn't this story been told? If it's true what I'm saying, that she was incarcerated for 7 years, then why is it that people don't listen to islanders or people who saw her? Like, what kind of prejudice do we have as humans where if somebody doesn't speak English the way we do, we don't believe them? Even though their stories are consistent. That's why I was talking about that newspaper article, because I thought that was kind of racist in a weird way. Like, you know, these people don't speak English well enough to understand your question. Like, come on. They're telling the story that their mother, and they don't care about an American. They refer to Americans as Europeans.
Right.
They're not thinking about an American pilot. They're saying, well, we saw a European woman dressed like a man. I interviewed the woman who saw her come ashore. And I interviewed another guy whose father was there. And the same story, everybody was told to bow their heads. And they saw her. Some of them didn't bow their heads. That's what Japanese are. And they saw Amelia and Fred being brought forward from the dock at Garapan, where the plane that brought them, the seaplane, brought them. So the Electra was on the Kyushu and eventually sailed to Saipan, which you can track that in records. Eventually it's parked in Saipan. So that was offloaded and put on Aslito Airfield. Philip and Amaron saw that the plane, there was something wrong with the wing, like the wing was broken or something.
Right.
And so who repaired it? I don't know, because Tom Devine sees it flown along with other GIs.
That's a good question. Yeah. So somebody had to put some work into it.
Somebody had to put it together. And there is, you know, stories, Fred Gerner mentions it, where the Japanese started putting out planes that were just like Electras, you know, so it's clearly that they were copying something about it. I don't know if it's clear, but that's the implication. But still, somebody repaired it and they flew it. And so now you have GIs who destroyed it and they push it off the airfield into a pit. And most of them, you know, like Erskine Neighbors, when I said to him, you know, why are you telling me this story now? And he said, we signed an agreement not to say anything for 50 years. And he said, and a year ago, I was at a reunion and I started asking people and somebody showed me Tom Devine's ad that he put in the Marine, you know, journal saying, looking for people who saw, and he responded.
But
you know, here he was speaking and Robert Wallach. So Tom Devine and Robert mentions Robert Wallach and they had met. So I went up to Bob Wallach, U.S. Marine.
That was my next question, was to tell me about Wallach. Yeah.
So, and it fits in the story in a weird way, which is, so I go up to see Bob Wallach and he tells me the story of how when he was on Saipan with some other guys, they had blown open a safe that was inside a church. They saw a safe and they put some, they blew it open and it flew open. And Wallach actually said, you know, I'm going to be rich. And he went
Yeah.
and there was Amelia Earhart's briefcase. Now, he described it to me. He said he opened it up. He saw her passport. He saw maps. He saw charts. And then he carried it in his rucksack for 2 weeks. So imagine you're in the middle
Yeah.
of buying, you know, he gets shot in Okinawa, but he for 2 weeks he's carrying around. And finally, one of his friends says, you know, if you turn it over, they'll give you a receipt and you can pick it up at the end of war. Little did he know.
Yeah, right,
but anyway,
right.
So he gets the receipt. He gets the guy, signs it for him. But here's what's fascinating. It's given to Clarence Wallace. It's taken to the tent where Erskine Neighbors, the wire operator, sees it. He sees it brought in. And I have him independently describe that briefcase. And it's exactly what Robert Wallach said. The way it's shaped. And if you look at footage of her packing for the last flight, you can see her with that overstuffed
briefcase.
Mm-hmm. Picture of it in the book. But, you know, so that's another weird anomaly. Robert Wallach found her brief, you know, passport, you're not going to have it in more than one place.
I know.
Her charts and her, you know, the permissions. And by the way, you know, she asked for permission to fly over Japan in 1936 because the original route was going to take her from, you know, Oakland
right.
over across Japan. She was going to fly over Japanese airspace. And they approved it. When I went to Tokyo, and people always say to me, you should go to Tokyo. Well, I went to Tokyo. I went to the military museum there. I got in, which took a little talking. And so I asked the librarian, I'm thinking to myself, you know, paranoid, like, do they know why I'm here? No.
Yeah.
I said, look, yeah. I want to see the records from every prison that Japan maintained during World War II. And by the way, that movie Unbroken that Angelina directed comes directly from one of these journals. So the guy comes out with, I think it was 18 books, volumes, huge, translated into English. And one side is Japanese, the other side's English. And I'm looking through all the books and one's missing.
Right.
And I said, why is Saipan not here? I mean, that's where the Japanese military headquarters was.
Yeah.
It would be like the records from Pearl Harbor are missing. Well,
right.
He said what he said to me was all of these were sent back to the United States to be translated. And that one didn't come back for whatever reason. So it may still exist here somewhere. It's possible. I don't know. But it doesn't matter. By omission, you see, you show your cards.
Right.
One card that's missing is this particular thing. And if you talk to someone like Les Kinney, who has done, you know, his clearance is pretty high, you know, he's a guy who is. And so he's actually seen some of the court records, like the inquest that was held in Saipan after the war, where they were discussing not Earhart, but discussing these other pilots who had been shot. But I'm telling you, I interviewed two guys, and they're in the book, two different gentlemen in their 80s who they were both about 10 or 12 years old, and they were sitting, you know, in their grade school when this truck pulled up, Japanese truck. On the back was Amelia and these two other U.S. pilots.
Jesus.
And she was parked there for like a half an hour. And one of them said that she tried to speak to them. But they didn't understand what she was saying because she was speaking in English. You know, it wasn't like, you know, can you get me some water? I don't know what she was saying. But imagine those two pilots who thought that she had disappeared. They're driving around in the back with her. They get executed. Yeah. She survives. And I guess, you know, they just never, maybe they thought, you know, it wasn't worth killing her. Or maybe it was, I don't know. I don't know why they didn't just, execution was off the table for whatever reason. I can tell you that when I've asked these questions, you know, via mediums to Amelia, she gets emotional when she talks about the nuns who took care of her.
Right.
And who apparently moved her body because the Japanese soldiers, when she died of dysentery, they dumped her body in a pit along with where Fred's ashes were. And those nuns moved her to a more appropriate place for a burial. And that's where I'm pinpointing where that is. And Mike Harris has had me on the phone. He's like, let's go back there. He's saying, are you? And you know, it's also weird, Chris, is like we Mike and I got there and the first place we went to take a picture was there.
Right.
Literally 5 yards away from where now I think that the rest of her is buried.
Jesus. We're going to do a two-parter. I have one more question I want to ask you for this first part. What do you think people in general, the general public, what do you think ultimately they want the truth to be?
In terms of what the public wants versus who she was.
Yeah.
And this is how we started this conversation.
Right. It's a good full circle question.
She was a woman who preferred women her entire life. She lived in an era when you weren't allowed to do that. And she met a guy who proposed to her 6 times and she said no. Clearly he knew why. But the 7th time she said yes. And she made him sign a prenup agreement. I'm sure you're aware of it. And it says,
well aware.
Clearly, if for any reason I want to split, I can. Mm-hmm. Now, I was curious who was the person that she was in love with. Who was the person in the poetry? And that's what I feel like I've been able to discern. She doesn't want to rewrite her story. She wants people to realize she lived a life of secrets. She was somebody who had to keep secrets her entire life. Her father was an alcoholic. He had been incarcerated for his alcoholism. That wasn't very well known. She was somebody who ended up having this incredible journey. But, you know, when she flew the first time across the Pacific or the Atlantic, she was in the back of the plane. So that was a secret that she didn't even fly the plane.
Mm.
And then when she flew 5 years later, she was supposed to land in Paris. She didn't land in Paris. She landed in Ireland. So, but they still gave her a ticker tape parade. But she became the pilot that they wanted her to be. So by the time that she was incarcerated, these mistakes had been made all the way along the line so that ultimately when she comes down, now, of course, you know, it's the greatest search in the history of the naval, you know, the U.S. Yeah. Navy. Now, you know, your question is like, did FDR know that she, everything I've come across is he did not know prior to what happened. And it wasn't until later that he discovered or learned what happened to her.
Right.
But the military knew what happened to her. They use it as an opportunity. They did. They used her like error, this goofy woman flying around mm-hmm. the world. Let's just use this her mistake. So mm-hmm. to benefit our intelligence. The Japanese were not supposed to be building deep water ports. They had agreed to not do that, but they were, clearly. Mm. Les Kinney found that photograph of a deep water port. That's why that was such a controversial photograph. Not because Amelia and Fred are in the picture. They could be, we don't know, whatever, he's 90% sure. But it was the concrete.
Yeah.
They had built a deep water port. So they're big ships which are going to come over and be part of a war, which would to break the oil embargo that the United States had put upon Japan.
Yeah. You
know, there's all kinds of things that we don't know about our world today, the politics today, the stories mm-hmm. today, mm. these stories where you find out, oh my gosh, you know, the government isn't really telling me the truth. They're telling me something that they think I need to hear. So
right.
was right. she used as a spy? Without a shadow of a doubt in my mind, was she aware of it? I think she thought she could overcome that. That wasn't important to her. That she would just get around. She would get around to the other side and they would write the book and they would be out by Christmas. That was the plan. You know, George had a real strict date, you know, and you got to get back by then. But mistakes were made, you know, and all those mistakes ended up costing her life. However, 7 years in prison, she deserves to be honored for that.
Yeah, we will have you back. There's so much I want to cover. And I think to keep it cohesive, we'll stop it here. The book is She Was Never Lost, The Amelia Earhart Saga. We'll have it linked in the show's notes along with all of the other things we spoke of tonight. Rich, this, you know, completes a big one for me tonight. Thank you so much for doing this, sir.
You're so kind to say, Chris, and I got to honor you. I think it's an important story from her perspective, who she was. People don't know. They're not looking at that. They're just looking about, you know, where did she go? And was she this? And was she that? They're just ignoring all these amazing things of who she was as a person who overcame so much to do so many different things. And we're still talking about her. I mean, she's still the most famous woman really in our history. And she deserves that kind of introspection. You know, why? Who was she in love with? What was her loves about? Why was she a poet? Why did she want to fly? You know, what did that mean to her? And what does it mean to us as humans? You know, our journey. Hopefully we don't have to be the most famous person on the planet for 10 years straight, and then the most notoriously missing person for 7 years after that.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you. Thank you, sir.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.